This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. NCAA regulations allow colleges and universities to entertain the high school athletes they'd like to recruit on campus visits. But if you believe the allegations, recruiters at some schools entice teenage kids with alcohol, sex, and drugs, while head coaches, athletic directors, and university presidents look the other way. The charges stemming from the University of Colorado's recruiting parties have already risen to the level of scandal, but Colorado is hardly alone. Several schools faced recent embarrassment. One football player recruited by the University of Miami was found to have a long criminal record. Another, an avowed Christian, publicly shunned schools that he said offered him sex and drugs on his campus visits. With so much money at stake in big-time basketball and football, the pressure to win is intense. Today on Talk of the Nation, we explore the practices of college sports recruiting, where the system has gotten out of hand, and what can be done to fix it. So whether it was water polo or football, if you were a high school athlete or the parent of one and got a taste of college recruitment firsthand, give us a phone call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now from his office at the NCAA headquarters in Indianapolis, Indiana, is David Burst, Vice President for Division I and Chair of the newly appointed NCAA Task Force on College Recruiting. And thanks very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
What in particular is the task force going to investigate, specific incidents or the rules themselves?
Well, it will be the rules themselves. I think your introduction was a perfect segue to a wake-up call for our entire membership, and I think probably our institutions individually are looking at their own practices. But the same kinds of allegations have given rise to the opportunity for the national organization to evaluate its rules. We have a number of recruiting regulations that concern time periods on campus and logistical kinds of issues, but very little in regard to behavioral aspects. And it's going to be the charge of this task force to attempt to develop some better rules and some that that include standards of conduct and accountability.
As I understand it, the current rules prohibit excessive entertainment. Without going into too much detail about what that means, but surely, prostitutes are excessive entertainment by anybody's definition.
Absolutely, yes. And it seems to me that the work that we're going to do has to be distinguished from the work that other groups are doing. The enforcement staff of the NCAA has long been in a position to evaluate whether particular practices violate our rules. We also recognize that issues that relate to illegal behavior have to be turned over to law enforcement officials.
But sure.
The place that we think we need to have an impact is the environment. And the immediate issue is our campus visit, and we're going to take a hard look at that. I believe that a parent that entrusts their minor child to the care of coaches in an institution for a weekend should have confidence that when he or she is returned to the home that they're intact physically and emotionally and informed about the academic team and social environment of the institution, if you will.
The task force is scheduled to present its report by late April, 2 months from now. Is that going to be enough time?
I think it is for the immediate issue of evaluating campus visits. That's an approximate 54-hour period that we're talking about, and we have a number of people both on the staff and on the task force who have experience in that area and have resources readily available, so I'm hopeful that we can meet that challenge.
Mm-hmm. Now, we've been, first of all, who is responsible on each campus for recruiting standards of conduct? Is it the head coach? Is it the athletic director, or is it the president of the university?
Well, I think generally speaking, from an NCAA perspective, we have a concept called institutional control, and we expect that the institutions themselves and to the highest level are responsible for the conduct of their program. Having said that, though, the explicit assignment of accountability for these kinds of activities that you've been talking about, mm-hmm. That have been alleged, are not very precise, and we believe that we should evaluate clearer standards. And in fact, the National Association of Basketball Coaches has suggested that we should have a strict liability rule for head coaches for the conduct of anyone associated with their program, and I think that'll be one of our discussion topics.
Now, the NCAA is a pretty big organization. Are we, as far as you're concerned, in terms of the intense competition for these athletes, are we strictly talking Division I-A and they're only some schools?
I think that's probably been the focus of the allegations in the very highly competitive programs, but that's not where the entire problem lies. Our task force will be made up of a cross section of Division I people primarily, but also with some representation from the Basketball Coaches Association, Football Coaches Association, and Division II. So we have 28 sports, and while the abuses typically run to the high-pressure sports of football and basketball both men's and women's, then it seems to me that we need to be looking at standards that we can apply across the board.
Now, there is a widespread perception, and I think your committee was appointed to battle it or to follow up on it, but that Colorado got caught, but a lot of other universities are just saying, glad it was them and not us. There are all kinds of reports of, allegations along similar lines at many institutions.
Well, it's hard for me to make a judgment about society in general or even intercollegiate athletics in general. I think that the positive, if there is a positive, is that we have a less threatening environment where the kinds of things that you're talking about can be articulated if we can find a way to get that done. And it gives us a national forum to try to address it. So I feel optimistic that we can have an impact on a national level, and yet I fully expect that we may hear more rather than less in future weeks.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've been involved at one level or another investigating violations of NCAA rules for a very long time, and it's hard not to come away a little bit cynical, as this does with respect seem to be about the umpteenth investigation, and every time the presidents and the NCAA say, oh, this is terrible, we're going to investigate, and it seems like nothing happens, and a couple of years later it happens again.
Well, I hope that's not the case. You're right. There have been a number of challenges to the NCAA or its institutions over the years, and it seems to me that we have been able to adjust accordingly. In this instance, it seems to me that most people, 2 months ago, would have said you don't need national legislation to evaluate such things. The environment is different now. And it seems to me that it provides the opportunity for the NCAA to have an impact in this area. I think that's always been a positive of the NCAA, to be able to transform itself in a manner that can be responsive to its institutions.
Well, can we invite you to come back with us and join us when the report's done?
You certainly can, sure.
David Burst, we know you're extremely busy today. We thank you for your time.
Thank you.
David Burst is Vice President for Division I at the National Collegiate Athletic Association. He heads the new panel on college recruiting practices, and he joined us from the NCAA headquarters in Indianapolis. With us now is Mark Eisenberg, co-author of the Student Athlete Survival Guide, operator of the website agame.com. He joins us now from the studios of KUCI in Irvine, California. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Good afternoon, Neil.
Tell us a little bit about what generally goes on in the recruiting process, a scandal aside. Say I'm a young quarterback who's showing a lot of promise. When does this process start?
At the first time that an athlete is identified as having the ability to play in college, he is going to start getting attention from the local media, the local people who operate internet websites that talk about the next lifeline of athletes that are going to be going to college, and then he'll start receiving letters from universities, from college coaches, just to express that they may have an interest.
He could be a sophomore or a junior at this stage.
You know, there's you know, communication that goes on at the earliest stages.
Mm-hmm. And once the colleges have noticed, when do the visits start?
The visits don't start until their senior year. Each athlete is given the opportunity to take five official visits, and those are free, all expense paid trips to the institution where they get the opportunity to see what's going on athletically, academically, and socially firsthand.
And the kids who get recruited, their parents also, how well do they understand this system as they approach it?
Not well, Neil. Unfortunately, I've done a lot of research on this subject matter, and it's always one of those things where I talk to the juniors and seniors in college, and they start to reflect back on their experience, and they, you know, the common denominator has always been, if I only knew then what I know now, how much more prepared I would have been to handle these type of issues.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, going through it for the first time is a daunting task for both parent and child.
We're asking those listeners who've experienced college recruitment firsthand or secondhand, if they were parents, to give us a phone call. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, our email address, TOTN at NPR.org. And we'll start with Solomon, who joins us from Greensboro, North Carolina.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
More of a comment than a question, but whenever I was in high school, a very, very good friend of mine was recruited by all of the ACC schools, and on one of his visits, I won't mention the school, he was not only given a cash payment, but a couple of young ladies were sent up to his hotel room to service him sexually. And I mentioned that not for the sensationalistic aspect of it, but for the simple fact of, first off, obviously, these type of things are incredibly difficult to prove unless the individuals who are present there while it happened, when it happened, admit to it. Mm-hmm. But the real core issue that I see now looking back is the culture of impressing the student athlete to attend a particular school. It's not necessarily that they are naive or that they're just bad people. From what I've seen from all levels of college athletics, even Division I AA or Division II, the culture of impressing the student athlete, of him having or her having this intense desire to want to attend the school based on athletics, not academics.
Just out of curiosity, Solomon, did your friend end up attending the school?
Absolutely.
Ah, interesting.
Absolutely. He attended, and to be perfectly frank with you, he told me...
I think Solomon has entered a dead cell zone, thanks very much for the call, if you can still hear us. Mark Eisenberg, it's hard to tell how widespread these stories are, but the Colorado situation is certainly not isolated.
Well, as a caller had mentioned, that there seems to be this culture going on in college athletics to impress the recruits and impress the parents. So, you know, what drives an athlete to sign at a particular school might be different than what appeals to a parent. So you isolate the kids and you talk to them about what they want. And unfortunately, there's so much money involved in big-time college athletics that people are, you know, working outside of the rules or even the spirit of the rules and putting them in positions that compromise not only the university but also the athletic program.
We're talking about recruiting in college sports, what the experience is like, and whether practices go too far. When we come back from our break, former University of Virginia athletic director Terry Holland will join us. If you've been involved as a parent, coach, recruiter, or athlete, we'd love to hear from you. 800-989-8255 or send us email, TOTN at NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about recruiting practices in college athletics for all sports, great and small. Our guest is Mark Eisenberg. He's co-author of the Student Athlete Survival Guide. Of course, you're invited to join us. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is TOTN at NPR.org. And let's get another caller on the line. And this is Nancy, and Nancy's with us from Portland, Oregon.
Yes, good afternoon. I'd like to find out from both of you, who do you think has the best college recruiting program in the country? I mean, we know about Harvard, Yale, Stanford for Scholastics. Why not talk about the good ones so that everybody will try to achieve that?
Well, Mark Eisenberg, those schools certainly get a lot of academic attention, but when it comes to the playing field, the big money schools are what? Notre Dame, Miami, places like that?
Well, and that's one of those things where I think that there are schools that are doing it by the book to a certain extent. You know, unfortunately, there's sort of this mentality that's sent to coaches, follow the rules or get fired. But then there's this catch-22. In reality, it becomes follow the rules and I'll definitely get fired. So it's very difficult to reconcile what's going on in terms of the messages that we're sending to college coaches about what will define as success.
And Nancy, obviously there are schools that do it well, and there's I've heard no breath of scandal about Harvard or Yale or Princeton.
No, I'm not talking about that. I'm saying that those are the schools that attract top scholastic people. If you want to attract top athletes, of course there are going to be some schools that are a little bit different than those that are a higher caliber athletic football or basketball. But why not talk about what the best schools who recruit, what they do, and what makes them so successful?
So best practices, in other words.
Yes.
Okay. That's a suggestion that we might want to pass off to Mr. Burst in the NCAA, but as they look at their regulations. But thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's talk now with Terry Holland, a former basketball coach and athletic director at the University of Virginia. He's speaking with us today from Charlottesville, Virginia, and it's very good of you to join us on Talk of the Nation.
Well, thank you, Neil. Good afternoon to you and Mark.
When you were athletic director at UVA, and certainly when you were the basketball coach there, can you describe the pressure that you were under to bring in the best players you possibly could?
Well, there is pressure, and some of that is personal pressure. In other words, everybody in this business is very competitive, but at the same time, I think the financial consequences today and the fact that our coaches are essentially told they have to produce this revenue, in other words, produce a winning team, and none of us do it intentionally. I must say that I know personally a lot of these people at the NCAA headquarters, as well as the coaches involved, athletic administrators all over the country, very highly principled and intelligent people. But I guess the point is that the kind of competitive forces that are at work today can finally grind down even our very best people. And I think that's why we have to think in terms of something a little different. Nancy sort of hit on it a little bit there, in terms of rewarding proper behavior and changing our reward system. Right now, the NCAA divides the basketball revenue. Basically, it goes to teams who win. And for every game you win in the NCAA tournament, that's one more share that your conference gets to split with all your conference schools.
You're talking basketball now, yeah.
Talking basketball only. But again, that's how we reward people for winning. Suppose we said to these schools, hey, we're going to reward you for recruiting every scholarship in football and basketball that you award to someone who fits your academic profile. We're going to reward you both financially and competitively. And that's just a symbolic gesture to start with, but at some point, maybe we can reach the point that people will start behaving in a different manner. The analogy I use is that if you take the 100 top fastest people in the world, put them on a four-lane track, tell them that at the end of the race, at the end of the 100 yards, the first 20 across the finish line are going to get rewarded handsomely. The last 20 are going to be fired on the spot, and the middle 60 are going to be told your jobs are in serious jeopardy. And in fact, if we can find somebody, we may replace you before next season. That's essentially what we're doing with our coaches. They have to be at a minimum in the top 25 if they're coaching a Division I-A football program. That means that 80% of our coaches get a failing grade every year. And their jobs are at stake. So if you put those people on a four-lane track and you tell them to race to the end, even if they don't mean to, they're going to run over somebody. People are going to get hurt inadvertently. And I think that kind of pressure is what we've got to find some way to relieve. The idea that the NCAA can make more rules, that they can punish the individuals that they happen to catch, is wrong. That's a flawed concept. And that's why I think we just have to go back and look at the fundamental problem and address the fundamental problem, not the It's like if you were a doctor and you're treating the symptoms rather than treating the disease.
Well, some might say that the fundamental problem is the amount of money that's involved, because it's such a, these two sports in particular, men's basketball and men's football, I guess there isn't really women's football, but certainly women's basketball is a growing sport as well. But the revenue streams are so important for, you know, Division 1A schools in those two sports in particular, that it is essentially corrupting, and that the pressure to win is so great that, as you say, moral individuals either do stuff that they wouldn't otherwise do, or just look the other way.
Yeah, and I think you're right. It's a fundamental concept, but you can change the way it operates. In other words, you can say, okay, we're going to find a way to financially reward those schools who do things that we want them to do, and that we're also going to find ways to reward them competitively. Just very simple. Suppose you said to schools, we want you to graduate your athletes, not in 6 years like we allow them to do now, but in 4 years. And if that athlete graduates in 4 years, they get a fifth year of eligibility. We reward you financially for graduating the athlete in 4 years, and they get to play another year, and they don't count against your scholarship limitations. Now you've given that team more scholarships for behaving in a proper manner, and you've rewarded them financially, and maybe not to the extent that they can be rewarded for winning games, but eventually you can create a whole different environment.
Let's get another caller on the line, and Norm is with us from Tallahassee, Florida.
Yeah, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Well, you know, both of my boys were recruited by Division 1A schools, the MEAC conference.
Mm-hmm.
And then 1AA conference, and they both attended and I suspect that they both were recruited with young ladies, and that sort of thing. But I just kind of wondering, where are we going here with this? It's because yesterday we concluded an episode on Sex in the City, and sex was glamorized. I mean, sex is part of the infrastructure of the society. We don't punish. In fact, we reward shows. The more audience they see, you know, the more money they make. So how are we going to apply this now to football programs? And what do you expect young men to do if you put 19-year-old, 18-year-old kids in front, take them far away from home, put them in presence of beautiful women? I mean, what do you expect? What would happen? And I'm just kind of saying, maybe we're moving a little too fast on this, and particularly in an environment where you have that is driven by sex, you know, by glamour and sex.
Norm, with respect, I mean, there is a difference between, a television program. Yes, it does celebrate sex, but the women in that program are a good deal older than 17- and 18-year-old high school kids who are coming to a college campus to be recruited for an athletic program.
But remember this, you know, young kids are influenced what adults do. That's why we have the drinking age at 21 rather than at 18, because the 18-year-olds are influenced by those people who are older.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you have a society that's, you can go to any magazine, any drugstore, and see Sheer magazine or Vogue magazine, Oprah magazine, and they're talking about sex, how to look better, and whatever. You see the show like...
I think we get your point, Norm. Terry Holland, is he right about the about this? Are we going overboard with this?
Well, certainly I agree with Norm that societal forces do affect athletics, but that doesn't mean we have to give in to them. That doesn't mean we're always going to win either. I mean, in other words, this is a battle that you're in for the long term, that we're going to try to do the right thing and we're going to try to reward positive behaviors. I think if we could approach it from that standpoint, we'd have a chance of making some headway. Right now, there's no question, but there we're losing ground. Someone said earlier that it seems to be happening on many campuses, and that's probably true. And certainly there are societal forces at work there that we'll never totally contradict. But we can continue to work at it, and we can make progress. That doesn't mean we're going to solve those problems immediately.
Let's get to Jessica on the line. Jessica's with us from Tempe, Arizona.
Hi, Neil. I actually was became familiar with this issue last year when I was editor of our school newspaper at Arizona State University.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of stumbled onto this practice. We have they're called Sun Devil recruiters at our university, And just kind of looking into it, it just seemed to us as an editorial board at that time that it was just a really disgusting practice that was objectifying women and leaving open opportunities for what's just recently happened in Colorado. So when we came out and criticized it, and we were kind of counterattacked by the athletic department, but just kind of looking at, we did a follow-up story and looked at not only like the Pac-10, which we're part of, but Division I schools, like various Division I schools around the country. And we found that this is just a really commonplace practice, like really deeply ingrained in schools all over the country. And
it certainly raises questions, and I don't mean to cut you off, Jessica, for Terry Holland. I mean, it's one thing to say, you know, geez, boys will be boys. Do you want to send your daughter to that school?
Yeah, I mean, exactly. And being a female student myself, I think the practice is kind of archaic as it is, but the fact that our university, and Arizona State University, which has gone through a lot of issues trying to revamp its image and try to be viewed as a more serious academic institution, a university that's sanctioning this, it's like they're saying one thing out of one side of their mouth, and out of the other side of their mouth they're saying, well, it's okay to objectify these women and use them almost as bait to lure football players and
Terry Holland, let me ask you, there seems to be, and Jessica, thanks very much for the phone call. Sometimes when these issues come to light, and it happened again in Colorado, there's an awful lot of pressure, alumni, parents, and other people, on the people who bring these charges to light.
Well, there certainly is. But again, I think if you said to every AD in the country, we're going to eliminate this practice of allowing whatever the group is called on campus to show football players and basketball players and other recruits around, every AD would buy into it immediately. The problem is it's very difficult for any institution or even any conference to react unilaterally to these types of suggestions because the competition is so fierce. And
for
so
fear
what
that
you do
State
is you,
U down the road is doing something different. Yeah,
you try to convince yourself that the way you're doing it is not going to lead to trouble. And, you know, you work hard at it, but that doesn't mean that, let's face it, that's basically asking for trouble when you create that environment. Norm was right. The young lady who just spoke from Arizona is absolutely correct. We're asking for trouble when we put kids into that environment.
How far out of the norm do you think what we're hearing out of Colorado is?
Well, I'd like to think that it's totally out of the norm, but I've learned through the years that anything that goes on, it's so competitive that it's unlikely that any institution is doing something that is totally drastically different from other institutions. Now, again, all of us want every safeguard in place we can to prevent that from happening on our campus, but I think every single, and I'm not an athletic director today, but I know that you always dread that phone call that says something happened. No matter how hard you guard against it, you're only one phone call away from being in that same position that some of the institutions in recent years have been in.
Terry Holland, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Neil.
Terry Holland is the former athletic director and basketball coach at the University of Virginia, and he spoke with us from the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities in Charlottesville, Virginia. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Mark Eisenberg is still with us, and let's get another caller on the line. And this is Ann, who's with us from Columbus, Ohio.
Hi.
Hi.
I have two children in high school. One's a junior, a male, and a sophomore who's a female, both of whom are high school athletes and both hope to be recruited in the next year or so. And I was wondering, as a parent who might potentially have a child in a situation, you know, such as we've been discussing, what are you supposed to do if something happens and not ruin your child's chances, you know, for a potential athletic scholarship?
Mark Eisenberg?
Well, I think that it's one of those things where we actually can appreciate that these type of issues, however difficult it is for the specific schools to deal with them, but that they're putting these issues on the radar screen so that we can talk openly and cite specific examples of what allegedly took place as opposed to hearing rumors and, you know, this is, you know, what may have taken place. We're no longer turning our back to this type of thing. And so the more you can stay involved as a parent to educate yourself about about the issues that are going on, and not just allowing yourself to be a part of the magic carpet ride that recruiting tends to be when you leave it in the hands of football and basketball programs. So, I mean, I would really encourage you just to find out what type of information is available, read up as much as you can, talk to fellow parents who may have had a son or daughter who have gone through the recruiting experience, and get an idea of what type of questions that they asked, how did they go about getting access to research and information that was independent and not just filtered through the university or the coaching staff that might be in certain ways self-serving.
And good luck.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye. Let's speak now with Sean, and Sean's with us in Flagstaff, Arizona.
Hello?
Hi, Sean, you're on the air.
Yes. In regards to the gentleman actually just made a pretty good point about the parents becoming involved.
Mm-hmm.
And taking from a first-hand perspective, I used my 5 visits to various Division I AA schools, and after the first recruiting visit, if you as a parent do not understand what went on the night before, they're blind. Because from my experiences, we went out, coaches let us off and pretty much entrusted us to our recruitment advisor or the fellow positional teammate that you would be assigned. And we went out all night and came back for our brunch with our folks Sunday morning, and we were all in bad shape, and that stood for every single one of us.
Hungover, is that what I'm hearing?
Yes. And so, I mean, as a parent, you come into this your first recruiting visit, and we're very open, because we're looking to these student athletes as authority figures, as this is what we want to be the following year. We want to be playing football for this school, and when we go out, you go out, and you go out big, and you're 18 years old, and you're very impressionable. And the use of alcohol is a great way to alter the mental status of a recruit. And as long as you wake up the next morning thinking, God, I had a great time, they did their job. They got you to think about that institution. So I think that it's almost a fallacy for a lot of people to think that this is just something new that has happened. I mean, I went on my recruiting visits in 94, 95, so I mean, it's been happening since then.
Sean, thank you very much for the call.
Oh, thank you.
When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Mark Eisenberg, take some more of your calls, and talk about the checkered past of NCAA recruiting practices of college, even before the NCAA. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, and we're speaking now about collegiate sports and about recruiting. Our guest is Mark Eisenberg, co-author of the Student Athlete Survival Guide, and let's get another caller on the line, and this is Bill, and Bill's with us from Peoria, Arizona.
Hi.
Almost said Illinois.
No, that's Arizona.
Go ahead, you're on the air.
The problems are you got too many rules, and these rules apply to every athlete, male or female, major or minor sport. Not everybody's a blue chip pre-NBA or pre-NFLer. I have a granddaughter who is having difficulty right now. She's an honor student in junior college who's going on after her second year, and she can't be called more than once a week according to the rules, and the coaches have been having great difficulty because she's an active student athlete with an awful lot of schedules and schedule changes, so she can't even be called more than once a week according to rule.
Mark,
kind of silly to have rules that detailed for a minor female sport, isn't it?
Mark Eisenberg, there are an awful lot of regulations already that the NCAA has.
Well, and the caller brings up a great point that there are, are so many rules that we're dealing with, and all of these are in reaction to some situation that took place, and this was the way that the NCAA and their membership felt that they could, in their words, create a level playing field, so there isn't a recruiting advantage that one school would have over another. And that's what we're faced with now, is this rule book that addresses things like the number of colors allowed in a recruiting brochure, the times that calls can be made to prospective student athletes, but they don't necessarily speak to the real core values of what we want college sports to represent. And that is something that the NCAA finds himself in this position now of saying, hey, why have we not ever looked at these type of issues and say we need to be more involved? And it's very difficult just in terms of the way the NCAA is structured, because it is a membership organization where the rules are voted on by the membership. And so a lot of times you have schools that don't want to be told what to do, and so therefore these type of issues are being made at the institutional level.
Bill, we wish your daughter the best of luck.
That's a granddaughter, thank you.
Oh, granddaughter, okay, thanks very much. And Mark Eisenberg, thanks for your time today.
Appreciate it, thank you.
Mark Eisenberg is the co-author of the Student Athlete Survival Guide and runs the website agame.com, and he was with us today from KUCI at the University of California at Irvine. These recruiting scandals can make all of us long for the good old days when college athletics were wholesome, unsullied, heroic, but then there's the question of when exactly was that golden age? Joining us now is Catherine Jay, author of the forthcoming book, More Than Just a Game, Sports in American Life Since 1945. She's a professor of American Studies at Barnard College in New York, and she's with us from her office at the school. Nice of you to join us.
Thank you.
So are there any good old days that we can turn to in collegiate sports, or is the whole history equally sordid?
Well, certainly for college football, there really is no golden age. That the problem with football, the problems with football are built into its conception and development, and cheating and corruption have been a part of the game since the 1880s.
It was that early?
That early, yes.
Give me a for instance.
Well, there were no eligibility rules. So now the NCAA has a rule book with thousands of pages. There were none then. So there were no eligibility rules. Schools routinely used graduate students. There were, in the 1890s, what were called tramp athletes. So a school might play a team, find a player on that team that was particularly good, and recruit him to join their school the next season, the next game.
I see. And when did college football become really the big money business that it's really outrageous today?
Again, Thanksgiving Day games start in the 1880s. By the early 1890s, there are about 5,000 of them across the country. So football teams are already leaving campus and going to big cities and making a fairly good chunk of change.
And as the song goes, I guess you've got to be a football hero to get along with the beautiful girls.
Exactly. So that's very much a part of it as well. And so though most, say, cheerleaders were men until World War II, basically, the association between male virility and football has also been there pretty much since the inception.
And when was it that the athletic department of big universities became sort of separate from the rest of the university?
Well, again, the game was invented by the students, so it wasn't necessarily ever under the control of the faculty. So it was invented by the students. Often then there would be either a volunteer coach, and then by 1892, paid coaches. So the administration never had a great deal of control over football. It was always sort of outside of the control of the school.
Let's get a caller on the line. Mark is with us from Oakland, California.
Hi. Thanks, Neil, for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to bring up the example of the late Paul Bear Bryant, the legendary coach at Alabama. He, quite by choice, decided to take an annual salary of $1 less a year than the president of the university was making, and he made that as a statement to say, you know, sports were not as important as academics. And if you look at, for instance, Gary Barnett's salary, I think he's making $1.6 million a year, which clearly is going to be more than any professor or certainly the university president that he works for.
He's the highest paid public official in the state of Colorado.
Right, and I think by college football standards, he's probably underpaid as far as other college coaches go. So, I mean, this is another way to look at this question.
Catherine Jay, when did college coaches start to make so much money?
It's a great question, and it really speaks to why winning is so important. Because once you start paying coaches, players want to win. Coaches have to win to keep their jobs. Amos Alonzo Stagg at the University of Chicago is the first in 1892, but by 1905, Harvard is paying its football coach double what full professors at Harvard make. And today, of course, Nick Saban makes at least $2.3 million a year.
Yeah, he just got that contract, though.
Exactly. And yeah. So he's the highest paid in the country. But often, either the coach or the football coach or the basketball coach is not just the highest paid person at the university, but in the entire state.
Mark, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And we were talking earlier with David Burst, the NCAA vice president and head of their new task force that's looking into recruiting. I may have been wrong when I said it was the umpteenth, seemed to be, investigation, but am I wrong?
No, you're not. There have been umpteen investigations. There have been umpteen serious scandals. Just think about SMU in the 1980s, and they closed down the program when it was discovered that the governor of the state of Texas was a part of giving the players funds, money for playing. This has been going on again, and the NCAA has started in 1905 to investigate abuses on the field, and they do it again and again. There are reforms, but nothing really ever changes.
Again, we are focusing on football as we're talking about it, but basketball scandals, going back to the point-shaving scandals of back in New York City shortly after the Second World War.
Right. So there are point-shaving scandals in 1950 and 1951. But again, the coaches that are involved in those keep their jobs. The players are reprimanded or often actually arrested in that case.
Mm-hmm.
But the programs themselves don't change very much. And, of course, there's another point-shaving scandal in 1961.
And more recently than that as well.
Exactly. So it's a cyclical thing, and there are minor tinkerings, but it's a very big entertainment business, and you don't want to mess up the model too much because it makes money.
Can you foresee a day when, obviously sometimes coaches do lose their jobs, and that there's already, Mr. Barnett has been suspended with pay, at least at the moment. But is this going to go beyond that to athletic directors, to university presidents who were, if they're found, if you didn't know, you should have known?
You mean that they'll lose their job?
Yeah.
Well, I think Barnett ultimately will lose his job if he loses his job, because keeping his job will hurt Colorado football. So it will be harder for them to recruit. I mean, perhaps that's cynical. So I think perhaps the college president could lose their job. But this is a fairly major scandal, and it doesn't look like the University of Colorado's president is in danger. This has all the elements for something like that to happen, but it hasn't happened yet.
Has any president ever lost their job in a scandal?
Probably, but I can't think of anyone offhand, so it hasn't been anybody important.
Or recent, anyway.
Or recent, right. But, of course, the president at SMU didn't lose his job.
And this was they got the so-called death penalty.
Death penalty, yeah, so they were gone for 2 years.
Yeah, couldn't play at all. Catherine Jay, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Catherine Jay teaches history and American studies at Barnard College in New York. She's also the author of the forthcoming book, More Than Just a Game, Sports in American Life Since 1945. And she spoke with us from her office in New York City. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.